Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Recently, fans lined up at First Parish Church in Cambridge, Massachusetts for a Harvard bookstore signing with former President of Ireland Mary Robinson. It was an event co-sponsored by Amnesty International, and many who came admired Robinson's activism.
Thank you for all you've done.
Not at all. Pleasure.
But the many Irish in the audience remembered her before she was president, a 20-something lawyer and senator who took on Catholic Church policy.
When I was in my teens starting to listen to the radio, there was this young senator saying outrageous things, talking about legalizing contraception and speaking up for women's rights.
And what were you thinking, listening on the radio?
Well, it was like... part enjoying, part scared, like, is she going too far? But then I think a lot of people who were still very Catholics had to admire her courage. I think people like my mother just had to give her the vote because she stood for what she stood for.
And how do you feel about her now?
Oh, my God, I brim with pride. I just brim with pride every time I hear her.
How did this devout Irish Catholic come to take on the church, stop going to Mass? Her new memoir is called Everybody Matters, My Life-Giving Voice, and we sat down with Mary Robinson to ask.
Well, when I was growing up, my first interest in human rights was simply because I was the only girl with four brothers. So of course I had to be interested in human rights and equality and elbows and everything. And I was so conscious that somehow boys became altar boys, men became priests, and the place of the woman was in the home or as a nun, or if you were lucky enough to have a talent as a writer or an artist or a pianist, okay. And I had an aunt who had been a nun in India, who had done wonderful things, had written wonderful letters to my father to send slabs of soap out because they were really very poor. And I was fascinated by this. So I said, well, why don't I become a nun? And the Reverend Mother at the time, who I think was quite a wise and shrewd woman, looked at me and said, Mary, I think you should go away for a year. And if you still want to enter the convent, we'd be very happy to have you. So they sent me to this boarding school and finishing school in Paris. And somehow, landing in Paris at the age of just 17, it was as if I suddenly had air to breathe. I could think my thoughts. All the questions, the whys. You couldn't talk about it in Ireland. You know, why is it that things are so different? Why is it only boys who become older boys? Why can't I do a whole lot of things because I'm a woman? And I read the philosophers. I was also very affected by the Algerian War in France and seeing the discrimination against women who happened to have a scarf or young men who looked to be from the Middle East being very brutally treated by French police really struck me. So when I came back to Ireland, I didn't want to subscribe in the guilt-ridden way, you have to go to Mass every Sunday, you have to do this, you have to do that. And I said, no, I'll try and live a moral life, but I want it to be a real commitment.
Well, the path takes you to school to study law. You're schooling at Trinity, but also you had a stop here at Harvard.
I was very lucky to come to Harvard in 1967. Harvard had a huge influence on me. My contemporaries were questioning an immoral war, as they saw it, the war in Vietnam. I was being taught in a way that was much more exciting than in Dublin, the Socratic method, asking new questions. Martin Luther King was assassinated in April. And somehow I had a sense that young people were taking on responsibility.
Well, as you say, you were so influenced by friends here in Harvard Square,
yeah,
who were going south to work in the civil rights movement.
That's right.
But before that, you give a speech at Trinity.
Yeah, that was at the end of my 4 years of studying law in Trinity. I went forward as the first woman to become auditor of the Dublin University Law Society, the Trinity Law Society. That meant I had to give an inaugural address. And this gave me an opportunity. This was the first time I could put it all together, all the things I'd been thinking about, that we shouldn't be equating law, criminal law and sin,
well,
as we were doing.
Explain why, because in Ireland, the morals of the Catholic Church are a part of the Constitution.
They were part of the Constitution and laws at the time, very much so. And so I decided to write my inaugural address on law and morality in Ireland, that we shouldn't have a prohibition on divorce in the Constitution, that we have to have family law in Ireland, that homosexuality should not be a crime. It's a matter of private morality between consenting adults, and that suicide should not be a crime. They were my four issues in 1967. But when I got up and delivered this paper, I remember at the end of it, I mean, I delivered it with great passion and conviction. You know, this is what I really believed in. This is what I had studied law for. And when I finished, there was a moment of terrible silence, and I almost fainted. And then people started to clap, and, you know, clap quite a lot. And I, oof. But when I tried to implement, when I was elected to the Senate at the age of 25, the first thing on my program was to legalize family planning in Ireland.
Because at the time, all forms of birth control in the buying or selling were illegal.
Yeah.
Except if women had a problem with their menstruation. And as you say, interestingly, 95% of the women in Ireland had problems with their menstruation, yeah, so that they could then get this, yeah, prescription. But
we used to think it was the weather. For somebody coming back from the Harvard Law School and looking at this analytically as a lawyer, in Shakespeare's terms, the law was an ass. We were all objecting one way or another, but I was in a position as an elected senator to introduce a bill with two male colleagues who supported me. I suddenly found I had opened a kind of wound in the Ireland of the time. I got hate letters. I was denounced from pulpits. The then Catholic Archbishop of Dublin had a letter read out in every parish in Dublin which said that this proposal, and I remember the words, would be and would remain a curse upon the country. And the following day, the Irish press had a headline, "Curse upon the country." And I actually, I talk about it quite frankly sometimes to young people, because I did wobble. But when I steadied, I said, no, I'm going to do this anyway. We changed from criminal law to health and dealt with family planning as a health measure. And then 9 or 10 years later, the Irish government passed a law.
Well, you also went on to be a lawyer and had tremendous successes there, taking some of these cases to courts outside of Ireland. For instance, two women challenged the law that prohibited women from sitting on juries.
That's right. That was one. And we actually used American constitutional law to help with that one.
Overturned a law that prohibited mixed-race couples from adopting.
Yes, that was important because, again, that reflected more Catholic teaching than otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. You left Ireland. You took another case out of Ireland to the European court. And this was Josie Airey, am I,
yes,
saying that correctly?
That's right, you are.
She couldn't get divorced from her husband even though
he was separated from her husband even though he
was alcoholic, yeah, and beat her.
Yeah. She was a wonderful woman and she wanted a judicial separation. There was no divorce under our constitution.
Right.
That has now changed, but at that time. But she was the one who wrote a long letter on her own initiative to the Commission on Human Rights in Strasbourg. She couldn't get access to court to protect her family life. We took the case and we won. And that was extraordinarily telling because we won not just for Mrs. Airey and Irish litigants, but for Europe. Because when you take a case successfully in Strasbourg, it's for Europe. And I still remember getting a note, a handwritten note, from one of the leading barristers, Tommy Connolly, whom I thought was a god at that time. It's a handwritten note saying, "Mary, this is an extraordinary breakthrough in law. Well done," or something. You know, I mean, as a young lawyer, when you get that, it was quite something.
Mary Robinson, her new memoir is Everybody Matters. She spoke in Cambridge, Massachusetts. When we come back, being president and her new project, the Mary Robinson Foundation for Climate Justice. And by the way, for the Irish in the audience later today, cabbage, every way but boiled. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Mary Robinson, the former and first female president of Ireland, who also served as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She has a new memoir. We met up with her at a well-attended book signing in Cambridge, Massachusetts. While she signed, we asked her about her stand on the Magdalene Laundries, the church-run institutions where thousands of Irish women, mostly unwed mothers, were virtually enslaved. The last one closed in 1996. Just last month, the Irish government officially recognized the state's role. But we wondered, what did Mary Robinson know as president?
Did you know about this when you were president? Did you feel...
I not only knew about it, but I actually tried to give some sense of dignity to the Magdalene Laundry women by unveiling a seat in the St. Stephen's Green. And that was the first time that they had some sense that they were important and worthy of a president. And I was very aware of just how terrible it was.
Do you think as a president you could have done more?
I had different power. No, I think I didn't have the political power to, you know, in order an investigation, etc. I think what I was able to do as president was to use the words in Irish, Manon na Héireann, women of Ireland, which up to then had been derogatory. Ah, Manon na Héireann. As a president-elect, to use the, I reinvented Manon na Héireann. But I couldn't politically
take on the political issue of the Magdalen women, but I could honour them, as I did by unveiling that seat, you know.
The Irish presidency is largely symbolic, as opposed to the change Robinson was able to achieve as an activist lawyer. But as we sat down to speak before an audience, she said she took advantage by creating powerful symbols.
On the night of the election count, in all that excitement, I said that I would put a light in the window of my official residence for all of those that had to emigrate from Ireland, all of those that had to leave over the decades and the centuries. And I had no idea how powerful that light would be. People wanted to see the light when they came to see me, but also when I came to this country, Canada or Argentina, people would say, we know you have a light in the window, and it matters.
People who came to see it, I'm thinking of Tip O'Neill.
Yes, and he said, I want to see the light. We were in the sitting room, so we came downstairs, and I turned around, and tears were literally flowing down his cheeks. It was very, very moving. And being able to, able to represent the people of Ireland in a human rights way was for me very important. I was the first president to go to Somalia for the hunger and conflict there. And then in 1994, I went to Rwanda. I was the first head of state to visit after the genocidal killing. And on behalf of a small country, to be able to have that moral voice as well was very important.
After the presidency, you joined the UN, the High Commissioner of Human Rights. Such a difficult time. I'm thinking of Durban, you're having a human rights conference. It goes, by your own account, terribly wrong. There was some language about Israel and Israel being accused of genocide against the Palestinians. Countries were furious. It pretty much fell apart.
What I was determined about and pretty confident about was that we could get that language out, but neither the United States nor Israel were willing to stay with the conference, so they both pulled out. And we got a result with no bad language in it, a good declaration against racism, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, etc. But unfortunately, that was on Saturday, the 8th of September, 2001. And 3 days later, you had the terrible attacks in this country of 9/11.
Not only was Durban kind of wiped out of the headlines, I mean, not that was the least of your thoughts at that point, but there were people who blamed you, who said that the language of Durban, this language, this anti-Israel, anti-Semitic language, opened the door for the attack on 9/11. Mm. There was an American lawmaker who said exactly
Congressman
that.
Congressman Tom Lantos, the night that the conference adopted the Declaration and Program of Action, Shimon Peres, who at the time was foreign minister in Israel, said, this is great, Israel has won, there's nothing in that document to worry about. And unfortunately, because of 9/11, and partly because, you know, Tom Lantos did link the two and said this was part of the problem of 9/11.
That the attackers were encouraged by the anti-Semitism that they saw in the streets. But wait, we're not finished. You're a member of the group called The Elders. You get together with your friends Nelson Mandela, Jimmy Carter, Desmond Tutu. Is this the Richard Branson, Peter Gabriel group?
They had the idea that we needed elders in our global village, especially after the war in Iraq, because, in fact, Nelson Mandela had tried to intervene and persuade Saddam Hussein to leave Iraq, and there were some discussions going on, and then Iraq was attacked with shock and awe, and it was too late. And so they felt, we have to have elders in place. I'm one of the younger elders. I do want to emphasize that. We've tackled early child marriage and broad issues. I'm very interested in the only authority we have, insofar as we have it, is moral authority, to try to amplify what Nelson Mandela stood for.
But do you think it works? The conflicts now seem so ideological and intractable. Yeah.
Well, the conflict that I'm, or at least the issue that I'm most focused on now, is the issue of climate change. But I don't approach it as climate change. I'm talking about climate justice. To think not so much about melting glaciers and a polar bear on a melting ice floe, but actually to realize that climate change is undermining poor livelihoods all over the world. Those of you who've been in African countries will agree with me. Prolonged drought, flash flooding, no seasons anymore, and therefore we can't have food security. We can't have safe water. In a way, it's intractable. And I think that if we can change the perception about climate change to talk about people, linking human rights, development, and climate change, and helping poor communities and countries to adapt. You know, we have a world of 7 billion people, and 1.3 billion people don't have any access to electricity. 2.6 billion still cook on open fires with coal, firewood, animal dung, and inhale fumes, and at least 4 million die a year, and most of them are women. And we have the solution. We have clean cook stoves now, all kinds of varieties of them, and they're going out to 100 villages here and 100,000 there, but we're talking about 2.6 billion.
And this new passion of yours, and I can hear the passion, ties all your passions together, human rights, women's rights, but also this idea that it can end conflict, potentially.
Yes.
If people are not fighting over water, if they're not fighting over what they're eating.
If we can change to realizing that actually climate can bring us together. I'm a typical Irish grandmother. I constantly talk about my 4 grandchildren. What will the world be like for them?
Why do I think that there are some more battles ahead?
There are.
For Mary Robinson. Madam President, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Former President of Ireland, Mary Robinson. For more on books and projects, go to hereandnow.org.